Okay, so yeah, I've been reflecting about this theme, obviously, having this talk coming up, and I was thinking back to the first time I ever came to a Butterfield festival, 1998, Shepton Mallet, and I turned up and there was a Butterfield ritual in full spate. And it was dedicated to Amoghur Siddhi, who's the green Buddha associated with energy, with unobstructed success, with the midnight sun and things like that. And there was a group of people, I think one of them might be here right now, processing around the boundary of the site, chanting the Amoghur Siddhi mantra with extraordinary gusto. And it was unlike any Buddhist ritual I'd really come across before. I'd been a Buddhist for quite a while. I'd been going to the Brighton Buddhist Centre, and I liked puja. I knew that I was interested in Buddhist ritual and that I sometimes enjoyed it, but this was something else. So I was immediately fascinated, and I think really the reason I am here, the reason I got involved with Butterfield, which I did a couple of years later, and worked with Butterfield doing lots of things with the rituals for about 7 years, I think that's what's drawn me. So it's obviously there's something there for me and a lot of us to explore. So what was different? And I think there was this kind of element of abandon and play, which was really delightful. So there was a group of young women doing the can-can along with the Amoghur Siddhi mantra very joyfully, and I was interested that it didn't detract in any way from the more serious meaning of the ritual, that it was about connecting with this particular Buddha figure energy. And we were connecting with our energies. Fantastic. So I think I'm going to come back to this a little bit later, but one of the themes that's emerged while I've been thinking about this talk is two different aspects to ritual and to the arts and to life, in a way. Is going back to the Greek gods, two sons of Zeus, Apollo and Dionysus. And Apollo is to do with, he's the kind of young hero, he's the sun, he's about the light, about beauty, the arts, culture, learning, structure, form. So Apollo is kind of almost the quintessence of civilization, in a way. And I think all ritual, including sort of various religious rituals, have elements that we could call the Apollonian, that sort of the traditional structure, the way things are done. But Zeus has another son. I think he's got lots, but this is one of the other sons of Zeus, is Dionysus, he's the god of wine and the grape harvest, and with very different qualities, the sort of qualities of surrender, of ecstasy and chaos and abandon and that kind of thing. So different energies. And I think perhaps the thing that has drawn me to Butterfield and to the Butterfield rituals is that exploration of bringing in this kind of Dionysian element, that energy that comes from something more expressive, a bit more wild, a bit more chaotic perhaps, and trying to bring those two things together. And Nietzsche apparently wrote about this in terms of the arts, and in his view any true art contains both of those qualities. It includes that sort of I think the Dionysus, in a way, it's bringing in the shadow. You know, Apollo is the ideals and the sun and the mind and logic and the heart as well, but it's kind of about the light. And if we don't include those darker, earthier energies, they will come out somewhere. you know, we see it on Saturday nights. Dionysus is still regularly celebrated in our city centres, probably with his beery brother. Yes, apparently the Bacchanalian festivals happened five times a month, which was quite a lot, really, and they were pretty wild. And seen as being politically seditious and occasionally orgiastic. So Dionysus, in a way, definitely has a kind of darker side, and I'll come back to that, because that's something that that I've also been mulling over the last years. So let's start by just looking at ritual more generally. I mean, what is ritual, and is it still relevant nowadays? Is it just some kind of anachronistic throwback to earlier times with people, you know, around campfires trying to sort of get the antelopes to come their way, or whatever? Or is it some kind of primitive bonding with the tribe, or is it a bit more than that? Do we need it? Do we need it in Buddhism? Does it have a place in Western Buddhism today? The dictionaries, I mean, it doesn't tell us a huge amount. It normally says something. If you look up ritual, it comes the same root as rite. It's a recognized order of events at a religious or other ceremony, usually established by tradition. Does seem to be connected with the word religion. And that's interesting, because the word religion comes from a Greek root, I think, which is re plus ligiare, which is to bind together or to mend. And I think perhaps the rituals of older times were to do with mending, or perhaps re-establishing the connections between the human world and other worlds, so the gods of the weather, the animal realms, and so on. So so ritual, and we are all involved with rituals. They are a part of human life still. They always have been, it seems, and I'm guessing they always will be. So think about weddings and funerals. It's pretty well unthinkable that somebody would die and that we wouldn't have some sort of ceremony to mark that. So, a wedding or a funeral, for example, there's a huge number of examples. There's a certain recognised... We know roughly what to expect, don't we? The details will vary, and people will bring their own creativity and so on. There's a certain order of things that we know what to expect, and we'll just turn up, and then we'll just kind of relax into that and go with the ritual. And rituals do seem to have some kind of mysterious power. I mean, I always cry at weddings, and I've had this experience several times. I'm sitting there blubbing, and I'm thinking, I don't know why I'm crying. I don't know why, but, you know, it seems to kind of go straight in somewhere. Over the years, I've met a couple of people who've got married, still on the subject of marriage, who've got married for reasons that they thought were kind of mainly to do with convenience and so on, and have been really taken aback by the power of that ritual of getting married, that it was much, much more, it had much more effect than they expected. So, the psychologist Eric Fromm, German psychologist, he distinguishes between rational and irrational ritual. And irrational ritual is, I think, there's a bit of prejudice around ritual. and the idea, and I think, thinking about what Eric Fromm would be talking about, irrational ritual, which is compulsive neurotic behaviour, such as obsessive hand washing or something like that, usually done kind of privately on one's own. And as far as Fromm is concerned, the purpose of that is to hold back the return of the repressed. So there's a lot of anxiety associated with irrational ritual. So that's not the kind of ritual I'm talking about in this talk. His definition of rational ritual is shared action expressive of common strivings rooted in common values. Shared action expressive of common strivings rooted in common values. So I think that's a pretty good definition. And that's, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about in this talk. But I'm not very keen on the phrase rational ritual, because the whole point of ritual is that it includes other aspects of our being other than the rational. And I think ideally it includes both. Certainly Buddhist ritual, most of us, most of the time, we do need the rational element. We need to have our reason on board and understand, well, who is this Amoga City? What is all this about? We need a bit of that kind of information to connect with it. And we need to feel, yeah, okay, I'm, you know, I can go along with this. An enlightened being seems like a good focus to focus on those qualities. So, you know, there's this rational element, which sometimes comes more from the broader context, not necessarily within the actual ceremony itself. But certainly I think that needs to be there. But, you know, we're not just brains on a stick, are we? And I think the whole reason why ritual is such a deep human need, I would argue, is because it does include, it includes our body, our senses, things to do with kind of story, the way we respond to a drama or theatre or a story unfolding, the way we respond to beauty, things that move us. So it's heart and soul and also mind. So when I gave the title of the talk a while ago, but I would say heart, soul and mind, all of those things. So there are practices that we can do to develop our reason and our thinking and study and so on. I think we need to do that. But we probably won't get very far with our Buddhist practice unless we find, in fact, I would actually put myself on the line and say we definitely won't get very far with our Buddhist practice unless we find ways of getting those other aspects of our being, not just head, or not even just head and heart, but something more total on board with the practice, with those intentions, with those ideals. And I think ritual is a very good way of doing this, and I think that's why it's very much still with us, and that's why it's a really big part of this festival. So I think there's two central things that ritual can give us at its best, is meaning and connection, a sense of meaning and a sense of connection. So I'm just going to unfold that a bit. I think we can get a sense of how important it is to have this sense of meaning in our lives by recollecting times when we haven't felt like that, when everything feels just meaningless, pointless, you know, don't feel connected with anything particularly. And I think this is one of the key components of depression. It's already been mentioned in this series of talks, is obviously a big issue in the modern world, not just the Western world, I gather. So that sense of meaninglessness, what's the point of anything? Why bother to get out of bed? So, you know, beyond needing food and drink and shelter and all the basics and to be dry and warm, ideally to have dry socks, you know, that this sense of meaning is very important for us to just go on with our lives. And I think Buddhist ritual has a very clear meaning, generally speaking. So it will either be focused on an enlightened figure, a Buddha or a Bodhisattva figure, and of course an enlightened figure embodies all the qualities that we all have in potential. So it's the kind of ideal role model, and that's the focus in whatever way, whether it's a sevenfold puja or a different kind of, you know, Aramogisiddhi ritual that I mentioned earlier. And so that's where the meaning lies. And coming back to Fromm's definition about that it's shared and that it's rooted in common values, there's something about sharing that with other people that brings us back to times when we've had that sense of inspiration and connection ourselves, and we might lose it. I mean, I had that experience last night at Mahasukha's soulful mantra, whatever it was called. Just a sense of... The beauty of mantra, yeah. A sense of coming back to this figure of Manjugosha, who's been important for me, and having a kind of huge positive reinforcement, affirmation from everyone else being there chanting with me. So coming back to that sense of meaning, which it's so horrible not having that. Had a phase the last few years where I've been in that kind of meaningless zone quite a bit, and it's horrible. I don't want to live like that. So, you know, I think that's why I'm here in the rain and the mud and everything. I want, you know, I need that. So it might be focused on an enlightened figure, or possibly on a set of practices that we've undertaken and that we maybe need to remind ourselves. We need to, you know, so the refuges and precepts is something that, you know, we might at some point have decided that we want to take this kind of philosophy, this practice, as our way of life, and that means behaving in ethical ways where we can, as much as possible, being aware of that. So we chant the refuges and precepts over and over again to bring us back to that, to remind us. So I think the meaning is something that is very clear within these traditional Buddhist rituals, and it seems to be something that I'm sure not everyone connects with it, but there seems to be this universal quality to that. So we have the sevenfold puja, which is a kind of unfolding story. It's like a kind of drama where the first stage is the worship. Worship is the same root as worth, so it's to do with some recognizing worth in something, recognizing value, and then that's followed by paying respect, the salutation, the offerings. Maybe the mantra chanting comes at that point. And just wanted to say, chanting mantras, I find it very good to focus on my body, and actually sometimes lower in the body, and then it all kind of comes more easily. So the making offering, the kind of outward expression that this is something that does have meaning and value. And then the going for refuge, which is the decision to act on that. It's not just a kind of nice, lovely golden Buddha over there, and I'll carry on with life as usual. That this is something that I'm going to act on, that I'm going to make changes, and that's the going for refuge. We then come to the confession, which is the recognition of all the things that are holding us back, and that's a very important part of this journey, because if we don't recognize our obstructions, again, we won't get very far. I'd like to come back to a little ritual at the end, which is connected with that. So we recognize our faults, our limitations, but we're not going to let that stop us. And we also recognise the rejoicing in merits follows that. We recognise our good qualities and the good qualities of our community, those around us in the world. So not to get too stuck into the kind of what's wrong stuff. And then that's followed by the asking for the teaching. And again, this is a theme I'm going to come back to, that the importance of receptivity, that in order to learn something, we have to want to, we have to be open to it. And so the entreaty and supplication is an expression of openness to teachers and teachings, that receptivity. And then in the transference of merit, which we often do at the end of things, will probably happen in the closing ceremony at some point. And that's where we kind of, all the benefit we've gained, we kind of give it all away to benefit the world. So, I think there can be something just extraordinarily satisfying with, say, a good puja or a good ritual, sharing our most important values with a group of other people. And it hits a spot that very little else hits, for me anyway. So there can be a problem with these traditional rituals, which are maybe the more kind of Apollonian, if you like. They're repeated. The sevenfold puja, the words are always the same, we go through. It can lose energy, we can lose connection, we can just get a bit bored. And it's sort of, oh, I've done this lots of times now. We're looking for something a bit more from that. So how about this business of bringing on board some other energies? So at Butterfield, I think that's one of the reasons Butterfield has been successful, is because there has been, and the whole festival scene, I suppose, is there are opportunities for letting go and for expression and for that side of things, for that more kind of abandonment aspect. And I think it's really great that we have a space in which that happens. I think some of my favourite rituals at Butterfield have involved quite a wild kind of drumming and dancing and whooping and all of that, and people flinging their clothes off and all of that kind of stuff. But then moving into something quieter and more focused, and just sort of, so it's like you're getting those energies on board and then you're kind of taking it into something, because just abandonment on its own, Dionysus, the god of wine, you know, I mentioned Saturday nights earlier, you know, that can go into something very, very different and quite dark and not particularly helpful. So I think this wilder aspect, I think we have to be quite aware of where we're going with that. And if we're experimenting with something, part of the nature of an experiment is you try something and then you kind of check out, well, was that helpful? What have we learnt from that? And I think maybe we do need to, if we're exploring new forms of ritual, which we are, I think we need to keep having those conversations and picking up where things have gone wrong, perhaps, or gone off on a bit of a tangent. You know, maybe some big egos start to take over within that kind of more open space and take something off in a different direction. Or maybe that in itself also can become a bit repetitive. You know, I did have a phase with Butterfield where it's like, oh no, not another Butterfield ritual, you know, the drumming, the wailing, get me out of here, I just want a really quiet, focused sevenfold puja. So I think, you know, that we've just got to kind of tread this line and bring mindfulness and awareness to what we're doing and not get stuck in a habit. But I think there is a reason why there's an element of repetition in ritual, is because, well, we are creatures of habit. You know, we have the same thoughts, don't we? Over and over again, we go round the same, you know, anxiety loops and so on. We've got all these little neural pathways, apparently. And if we're going to make any real change, we are going to have to address things on that sort of level of things that are repeated over and over again. I mean, our less helpful patterns are repeated over and over again. So if we are going to counter that, we need something that we come back to over and over again in every, you know, on every kind of occasion, when we're feeling inspired, when we're not feeling inspired, when we're feeling bored and connected, you know, when we've got energy for it. We need to sort of stay with the practice. And I think ritual is like that, you know, same as with meditation. I think if we do lose the connection, there are things we can do to help that. Say we're doing Sevenfold Puja and just think, I know some people just say, oh no, Sevenfold Puja, you know, done it so many times. We need to sort of find our own ways of reconnecting, and one thing I think we can do is put more energy into the aesthetics. So take some trouble to create a really beautiful shrine, to sort of clear the space, you know, maybe wear nice clothes, dress up a bit, make it special. And the aesthetics also includes mantra, you know, maybe put a bit more energy, as obviously we are doing, into the mantra. So there's something really beautiful, really magical, that is going to move us. And those things can connect us back in. I think another thing that can help is the context, actually. The context within which something happens is key. So there have been times when someone's given a little Dharma talk, just a few minutes before doing a ritual or a puja or something, and it just immediately focuses the energy. So I think there are ways, you know, we can recognise this isn't working for me at this point. We can actually be proactive about that. So yeah, that was all to do with the area of meaning, and now on to this area of connection, ritual being about connection. So is ritual basically just a big thing that's about group bonding? Is it about which tribe we belong to fundamentally, and sort of doing something all together with our particular tribe, or is it a bit more than that? I would say it can be that, certainly, and that is something that we humans definitely do. You know, we look for something to belong to. But hopefully it goes beyond that. One of Sangharakshita's teachings that I come back to over and over and over again is things that he's talked about in terms of the true individual, the group, and the spiritual community. And I think this is relevant to our subject here. So the true individual, also known as a stream entrant in more traditional terms, ultimately, somebody who's able to take, we're able to take responsibility for ourselves. We're able to take responsibility for the states of mind we get ourselves into and the effect that they have on our lives and other people. That's a biggie. But I think perhaps that is the central quality. A true individual would be emotionally positive, or at least able to limit the damage when we're not in that space. Able to go it alone, speak out, be unpopular if necessary. So this is going on beyond that more sort of groupy thing. Able to cooperate with others and to be receptive to teachers and teachings. So again, this quality of receptivity, very, very important all the way through. A true individual is not the same as an individualist, a rugged individualist who wants to go it alone and you know, sees the tribe over there and they're over there but I'm an outsider. And so that's defining oneself in relation to the group. So let's go on and look at this group, capital G. So I don't know if this is Sangharakshita himself or if it's something he got from someone else anyway, but it was found this interesting. So the group, capital G, I think we don't have to look beyond playground or office politics to know what the group is like. So what you have to do to belong, what happens to you if you don't belong, the sort of pressures that you know, that you will be placed under to go along with the norms and so on, who's in, who's out, fitting in, all of that. So it's the element of having to conform to a particular set of standards. And, you know, that is the world we're in a lot of the time. We get socialised into whatever group we're part of. There's no getting away from that. And, you know, on a certain level, it's just the way it has to be. It's not even, it's necessarily a bad thing. It just is. But obviously we want to find ways of going beyond that as a community. We don't want to be operating on the level of, you know, snidey office politics. And there are different ways of connecting with each other. And I think there are, you know, bitching about a colleague is a way of connecting with somebody, but it's not something that we probably aspire to. So we're looking for other ways of connecting with each other that are more valuable, more positive. So Sangharakshita talks about the positive group. So still based in those sort of human tendencies that we have, we want to belong, we want to be part of something, we want to kind of find our tribe and so on. But there's a more clear and helpful positive focus. So I think the Buddhafield Festival often expresses this kind of positive group quality, that it's that we're coming together on the basis of something that is a little bit more than what we might usually, where there's a bit more awareness. We have this whole thing, no drink, no drugs. That's about that quality of awareness. You know, we have the talks and the meditation and the rituals and so on there. All these practices which are moving us, hopefully, away from that more basic level of the group, capital G. But the positive group is... The positive group is not the spiritual community, which is what we're ultimately aiming for. So, yeah, we might be feeling very bonded, and we might be feeling all loved up and all of that, and that's great. But it's probably very reliant on certain conditions, and maybe we're feeling all loved up, and sometimes I think we can get a little bit intoxicated with that sort of quality, but that can change very quickly. Somebody says something that, you know, hits a raw nerve, and suddenly we're feeling very alienated and upset, and so it's very dependent on a particular set of conditions. So positive group, great, but what we ideally are looking for is the spiritual community, coming together as a spiritual community. And this is something that is quite a big thing to aim for, but hey, why not aim high if we're going to aim somewhere? So the spiritual community, also known as the Arya Sangha, is a community of true individuals. So people operating on that, with that degree of self-responsibility, positivity, and so on. We often talk about Sangha, which is kind of the same as the spiritual community. And I think sometimes there's an assumption that, oh, because we're Buddhists, we're all part of the Sangha, that we are already the spiritual community. You know, we've gone beyond all that group stuff. And I don't think we have to look very far. With real Buddhists, try working on a team with other Buddhists. I don't think we have to look very far to see that that's probably not the case. And let's not kid ourselves that here we are, we're great, we're the spiritual community, we've got it sussed. Because from what I see and what I experience, I don't think that's the case most of the time. And that's not that that shouldn't be what we're aiming for. There's a teaching at the beginning of the White Lotus Sutra where the Buddha turns up and he says, I've got this new teaching that you haven't heard before. And a bunch of monks just, they think, no, we've heard all the teachings. What are you talking about, another teaching that we don't already know? And they stage a big walkout, so a whole bunch of monks just stand up and walk out because they can't believe that there's something that they don't know already. And I think there's a very real teaching for us, and it's to do with this quality of openness, receptivity, being willing to look at ourselves, not assuming that because we've got all the theory that we've got it all worked out, and that, you know, I think there's an arrogance that can come in sometimes. We assume that as Buddhists, you know, we've got this wonderful Sangha and we're somehow a bit above, you know, mere mortals out there, poor things. I suppose the point is this group aspect, the conformity, the individualism, it's part of the way we're made up. It's in the mind. So every time we go into a kind of us and them sort of pattern, that's what's going on. And the trick is to catch that, to be aware of that, to recognize that that's, you know, probably happening quite a lot of the time. So I think ritual in general covers a whole span of everything from the quite negative group, you know, think of the sort of Nuremberg rallies or something like that, very powerful ritual, not a very great focus, very strong sort of group element, through all sorts of things that are maybe more about the positive group, bringing people together, and a lot of our, we were talking about weddings earlier, those kind of rituals that we have in our lives that we go to. I mean, that's very often a sort of positive occasion for people to get together. And I think Buddhist ritual, no doubt other religious ritual as well, but Buddhism is the one I know more about, gives us an opportunity to get a glimpse of the spiritual community, of that level of connection, of coming together with those sort of shared aspirations with other people. It's the absolute best in us, and it's the best in other people, and that we're sharing that. And that's a powerful thing. The purpose of the Sevenfold Puja is to bring about the arising of the bodhicitta, which is insight leading to spontaneous compassion, because we've seen through all the things that block that. And I have to say that some of my best moments in my whole life have been at the end of a really good puja, that sort of sense of having come together with a group of people on that sort of level. It's magic. So do we have to be a Buddhist to do ritual? Well, obviously not. We've got lots of rituals in our society. I work in a special school, and our head teacher, she's brilliant on rituals. People arriving, people leaving. There's a sort of sense of ceremony, which I think really holds people together. It's a very positive place to work, and I think that's a big reason. My mum's partner had a big gathering for his retirement and for his 75th birthday, and he'd never had a party ever, not in his whole life. He'd never had any gathering that was about him and was a celebration of him. And he changed. There was something different about him after that occasion, which was really beautiful to witness. And I just thought, nobody should go through their life without being celebrated in that sort of way. Excuse me. So we can create our own rituals, and I think let's do it. It's a great thing to do. If you've got particularly a big birthday, one with a naught on it, I had a little ritual gathering for my 50th birthday, and I think it was probably the nicest birthday I've ever had. Very simple, but meant a lot for me. So, yeah, rites of passage, beginnings, endings, birthdays, somebody leaving. I think it's very good to mark these occasions so we feel like our life matters. We need to feel like that. So a few tips just to finish, finish the talk. Have a master of ceremonies. I think for most rituals that is quite important, that there's somebody who whose job it is to hold the space, and they know they're doing that, and other people know they're doing that, and their role is to be aware of how it's going, how everyone is, and just kind of witness that. And probably also partly that person's job to plan and think through the details. One of my learnings as a ritualist was on a retreat where we had this absolutely gorgeous shrine with these big red roses. And we were doing this whole thing about love and receiving love and the ability to receive love. And we had these lovely red roses, and we had these night lights around the shrine, and at some point each person was going to go up and they were going to take one of these lights which represented the love that they were receiving. And, you know, it was all very sort of happy with it. I realised, to my horror, that there were not enough night lights to go round. And that, you know, two or three people at the end weren't going to get the love, you know. So anyway, of course I scuttled off and got some more night lights and it was fine. But those kind of details, they matter. So, you know, do take the time to think it through. You know, think about what the intention is. If you're there to celebrate somebody, then really do that. Yeah, make it special. Mentioned that earlier. Make a lovely shrine. Dress up. Whatever, it does add something. We don't need to be falsely serious. Playfulness and humour add something. They don't detract from the, you know, from the focus. But we do need to be focused. And I think if you're in the middle of a ritual and you start having a little private chat with somebody about something else, that does detract. So, you know, like meditation or other practices, we have to kind of bring ourselves to it. Have a beginning, a middle and an end, and keep it simple. That was our mantra. Didn't always manage it, as I'm sure some of you are aware. And also keep it active and inclusive. So it's about action. It's not just about one person doing all the stuff and everyone else. It's not the sort of high priestess kind of thing. There needs to be something participatory, and obviously we encourage people to get involved, but we should never ever pressurise somebody into joining in unless they want to. I think that's very important. So okay, I think that's enough. That's enough of the talk, but I'd like to finish with a little bit of ritual, and we'll see how that goes. I'm very happy to have some discussion after that. If we're, I don't know how long it will go on or how that will go. So we're going to have a mantra, which I will start. No, someone else like to, someone who's been going to Mahasukha, who knows the Manjugosha mantra, the main part. Nope. Okay, I'll do it. You sure? Not just Billy, shall I? Okay, there he is there. So during the mantra, Bernadette is going to come and make a special offering at the shrine, sort of on our behalf, as it were. And on the shrine, after Bernadette's done her offering, if you want to, you can come and get one of these little boarding cards. This is a late arrival that you might have done one already, but if you haven't already done one, it's a boarding card, Butterfield Airways, flight BF2012. Destination unknown, via the present moment. Pre-flight check-in. Do you have any restrictive, limiting ideas or self-views that you wish to declare? For example, I am blah, blah, blah. I'm the person that doesn't blah, blah, blah. Or any other excess baggage you would like to let go of before boarding. Okay, so, and there's, I'm not sure what's going to happen to them, but there's a little spot in the information tent. You can return these later, or you can, they're going to be burned. Yeah. Okay, so they're anonymous, you don't have to sign it. You can then put it in the box in information, or if you can't be bothered, you could give it to me or Diyoti over there, and we'll do that. So there's a few pencils, there's not actually that many, so if any of you have a pen on you, perhaps you'd be happy to pass that round. So we'll do that after Bernadette's offering. Perhaps you'd like to just pass a few round for me. Okay. Or just leave it somewhere under the shrine if you want to. So, I don't know how long the mantra will go on. Feel free to head off if you need to, or if it carries on a bit. And I'm happy to have some discussion if we want to. Okay. So, let's have the mantra. Amarapachanati, 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 Amarapachanati. Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati. Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati. Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati. Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati. Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati. Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati, Om Marapachanati. Om Marapachanati. Om. Arapajanadi. Om 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 Arapajanadi. Like to stay for a bit of discussion. Anyone want to do that, or shall we leave it there?
Can we just ceremoniously give the guest a round of applause?
Thank you.